From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the state scrambles with shifting guidance on COVID and masking in public.
This guidance from the CDC dropped as a surprise on Michigan and a lot of other states, just as they were basically reconfiguring a lot of their masking and gathering rules.
And one Michigan business owner on decisions she made over the weekend.
If you are going to be in-store shopping, we did not change our rules at all. We are still distancing, we are still cleaning, and we are still requiring masks.
And writer Wade Rouse talks about the fragility and resilience he finds in friendship.
We all hurt each other in some way, big and small. We can betray one another. We don't be the friend that others deserve sometimes. And that's what this book explores too.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. To mask or not to mask? On today's show, we're going to dive into the amorphous world of mask mandates and what small businesses are deciding as they tackle changing regulations.
We want to be there to serve you. We are not interested in having political discussions. We just want to be there to make sure that we get you what you need. So just a reminder to please be kind to retail workers as you navigate this.
That's later in the hour. But first, we wanted to find out what Governor Whitmer's alignment with the CDC means for the vaccination benchmarks that she set just weeks ago. Here with the latest is Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hey, Rick.
Hello.
So I think the last time we talked to you was right after Governor Whitmer had published this structure of suggested benchmarks for reopening.
You mean
various,
the former structure?
Right. The former structure of suggested benchmarks that Governor Whitmer had set up to talk about how Michigan would begin to reopen if people got their vaccinations. And of course, some of it had to do with masking. And then the CDC issued this guidance last week saying that masks were not necessary indoor, outdoor for vaccinated people. What did Governor Whitmer say on Friday? Did she just wholesale lift up the set of benchmarks that we had been talking about previously?
No, as a matter of fact, the benchmarks still exist, and it's not entirely a technicality that, you know, there are still things that would happen when we reach 70% of eligible people vaccinated. But, you know, it deals with things like workplace rules as opposed to the gatherings and mask rules that exist for the public at large.
So did the governor or Michigan's Department of Health and Human Services announce anything new today, any adjustments to state benchmarks or guidelines as a result of CDC?
No, not yet. And I did specifically ask whether or not we're going to hear something. And I was told they're still sorting through it all and trying to figure out what to do next. I mean, we've got to remember that this guidance from the CDC dropped as a surprise on Michigan and a lot of other states, just as they were, you know, basically reconfiguring a lot of their masking and gathering rules when the CDC said you can largely throw them out the window. And so we're still in kind of that recovery period of trying to figure out what to do and how to do it next.
Rick, where would you say the biggest gray areas lie right now? It seems like businesses are in a bit of a quandary. You know, on the one hand, there is this set of state guidance. On the other hand, they probably have customers coming to them over the weekend saying, hey, the CDC says we don't have to wear masks anymore.
Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that they have to deal with, is that the CDC advice is advice. It's not a rule. It's not a law. It hasn't been promulgated in any sense. That what to do with that advice is the province of state and local governments. And so that's where we're at. I guess I would just go right to one inconsistency in particular. So we've got this new public health order from the state that says if you're double vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask now in most settings, that you can gather with other people who are fully vaccinated, things like that.
Meaning to say, if you've had both doses of a Pfizer or Moderna vaccination and it's been 2 weeks since you got those shots, right?
Yes, exactly. So you can maybe go into a store without wearing a mask, but the Michigan Occupational Health and Safety Administration rules still say if you're an employee in that same store, regardless of your vaccination status, you're supposed to wear a mask. So when are we going to see updates to the MIOSHA rules so that they're in harmony with what the state's public health orders are?
Rick, it feels like there has been some loosening of things like capacity restrictions mm-hmm. in Michigan restaurants and bars, kind of unofficially, I guess, even before the
CDC. You could call it
that. Yeah, right. Even before the CDC guidance came out. Mm-hmm. Has the state acknowledged any of that or made any suggestion that there will be crackdowns on businesses that aren't abiding by the rules?
Well, I think we've talked about this before, April, that the state has largely moved out of the enforcement business and into the incentive business. And that was what the governor was doing when she announced her vaccination incentives just before the CDC changed its recommendations, which kind of pulled the rug out from under that. And so the state is now back to, look, you're allowed to do a lot more. We're largely following the CDC recommendations, but don't take that as an excuse not to get vaccinated. And if I'm a public health official in Michigan, that's my worst fear.
Is there any additional guidance coming out from MIOSHA, that's the Michigan agency that has jurisdiction over workplace safety, if there will be more guidance coming out in the coming days?
We are told they're examining everything, which is to be expected, and that we should expect new orders. But the only thing that I've heard so far is that it won't be today, but it could be tomorrow or it could be the day after that.
Have you heard any crosstalk in Lansing, either from Governor Whitmer's supporters or her detractors, about how these developments, how they contribute to people's vision of her authority right now? She issued very tough guidelines early on. It sort of feels like the CDC really caught state governments, including Michigan's, unawares and undercut some of their authority.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why it feels that way, which is because that is the way it is. The CDC really blew up the structure that the Whitmer administration had tried to set up, a return to, quote, normal, unquote. But they moved quickly to deal with the new hand that they've been, you know, that they've been dealt. And so now it's just allowing a lot more. But that also means that, and this is not an entirely merely political argument, that Republicans are able to do an I told you so dance. You know, we could have done this a lot sooner, and that the CDC and now Governor Whitmer has finally caught up to what they'd been calling for. And now, you know, that the line has been moved again, there's a big contingent of Republicans who are saying, look, let's just lift restrictions altogether and let people make their own decisions.
Okay, so we had just passed the 55% vaccination rate, I believe, when CDC issued these new guidelines and basically blew everything up for Michigan. The next benchmark that Michigan was set to hit was 60%. Rick, do you know where Michigan's vaccination rate is right now? Have we hit that 60 yet?
The last number I saw was somewhere in the 50s and improving. But as we've talked about before, the higher that number gets, somewhat ironically, the more you're getting into that group of people who are the most reluctant to get vaccinations. And so, you know, there's a dilemma there, a challenge that you still want to hit. The magic number is 70%. And all of this, in some respects, makes it harder because you don't have the authority of orders behind you to move people in that direction. And you don't really have the incentive of lifting more restrictions the further you go.
Rick Pluta covers politics in Lansing for Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much.
So glad to be with you, April.
As the battle against the coronavirus marches on, Michiganders aged 12 to 15 have become eligible for COVID vaccines. Not every family has made the decision to get young teens vaccinated, but we spoke with one high school freshman in Grand Rapids who was glad to roll up her sleeve. Laura DeBoer is a ninth grader at City High Middle School. Laura, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
What has life been like for your family during the pandemic?
It's been interesting. I have siblings who live very far away. My brother lives in Minnesota, and my sister lives in Virginia. So we haven't been able to see each other very much. But we're hoping that with new vaccination availability, we'll be able to improve our social life.
Well, let's hope so. Are there day-to-day things that have changed for your family over the past year? Maybe even changed back again, too?
Quite a bit. I am part of the Grand Rapids Symphony Youth Chorus. And this year I decided that I wasn't going to be a part of that because it's all online right now.
Could you tell me a little bit about when did you hear that the Pfizer vaccine would be available for people ages 12 through 15?
My sister texted our family group chat to tell me that I could finally get it. And my mom responded immediately that she had already got me registered.
Oh my gosh. you guys were not waiting. What were the factors that made you feel like you wanted to do this?
My family is all vaccinated, and I've always been vaccinated with anything that was available. I work in a restaurant, and I think that it's important for me to feel safe in that environment that I get vaccinated.
What do you do at the restaurant?
I do a lot of things. I work at Aperitivo in downtown Market, and I wash dishes. I take orders. I work in retail. I package. I do school during the week and then take weekends off to work. It's been a little tough with mask regulations, especially since I do work in a restaurant. We've had to cut down our capacity a lot, but it hasn't been horrible. I really enjoy my job. Mm.
Do you think that this is going to mean any different things for you, being vaccinated, that you didn't do before? Like maybe definitely you mentioned seeing your siblings would be fantastic right now, but maybe seeing friends or doing other things related to school that you haven't been?
I think that after I get vaccinated, a lot of it will just be like internal satisfaction that I'm vaccinated now and I feel a lot more safe than I did before.
Laura DeBoer lives in Grand Rapids. Laura, thank you so much for talking to us.
Sure.
In a moment, writer Wade Rouse on Beach Reads and the Ties That Bind.
I've had so many dear friends from camp and from childhood, you know, many like the Clover Girls, you know, who I've lost touch with over the course of the last few years. And this pandemic reminded me to reach out and kind of recreate those friendships. And that's the foundational theme of the novel.
That's after the break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Not everyone's been able to stay in touch with friends during the pandemic, but for some of us, the connections with the people who know what you look like under that mask, those are the relationships getting us through. West Michigan writer Wade Rouse has a new novel, publishing tomorrow, about how we discover and rediscover each other, the ups and downs of friendship over the course of decades. It's called The Clover Girls. He joins us now to talk more about his book and more from his home in Saugatuck. Wade Rouse, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Wade, as some people may know, you have written for quite some time under the pen name of your grandmother, Viola Shipman, in tribute to her. Can I ask what she would have thought of the pandemic?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. You know, my grandparents, my grandma Shipman was, both of my grandparents were working poor. And my grandma Shipman was a seamstress who stitched overalls her whole life and sacrificed really for my family to have a better life than she did. And, you know, I think I've thought about that a lot over the last year. My grandparents went through as much or more than we have over the last years. You know, I look back at what they endured and they went through war and poverty and disease and depression.
Do you mind telling about what were some of the formative trials of her life? I mean, she certainly lived through the Vietnam War.
Oh, yeah.
Was she old enough to remember Korea or World War II?
Yeah, my grandmother, you know, actually was a Depression era child. So I think that stuck with her for a very long time. And, you know, she didn't graduate high school. I think she finished sixth grade. And she spent her whole life toiling and working. And my grandpa Shipman was an ore miner. And when that work dried up, he raked rocks in order to make money to put food on the table for his family. And, you know, their whole life was just spent working for me and my mother to have a better life than they did. And, you know, they never complained about anything their whole life. All they did was, my grandpa used to say, if anything gets too hard, just put your back into it a little more. And that's the philosophy I've always really strived to achieve.
What was your grandmother's method for getting through hard days?
You know, she used to always say, big doses of faith and few regrets. You know, it was a matter of believing in something greater than herself and that things would work out, but not complaining, just getting through the day as best she can. And, you know, every single character in every novel I write is inspired by a woman like my grandmother, you know, just good, hardworking women who are really too often overlooked in life and in literature.
For sure. This decision that you've made to write under her pen name, why is it important? Do you think it takes you to a different place when you approach your writing life than you otherwise might be in? We should say you've also, of course, written nonfiction memoirs as well under your own name.
I do. You know, I think in every novel I write, the focus is on what my grandmother always called the simple things in life. You know, the things that we too often take for granted. And those are our family, our friends, our health, having a roof over our heads. You know, all the things that we too often take for granted, but we've been reminded of this past year. And those were central in her life, and they're central in every book I write. You know, my grandmother's favorite phrase was, life is as short as one blink of God's eye. But too often in that blink, we forget what matters most. And I think we've been reminded of that. And she constantly reminds me of that.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about Clover Girls, which is, I believe, your seventh Viola Shipman title so far. It's about four best friends who met at summer camp and grew apart and who were unexpectedly brought back together. Where did this idea originate? Did you have any childhood camp friends?
I did. You know, the idea of, I think I've carried around this idea for a very long time, but, you know, it really came front and center this last year when we look back and see, you know, who's really been there for us and, you know, buoyed us over, you know, what's been a nightmare of a year. And it's been our friends. And yeah, you know, I've had so many dear friends from camp and from childhood, you know, many like the Clover Girls who I've stayed in touch with, but many, you know, who I've lost touch with over the course of the last few years. And this pandemic reminded me to reach out and kind of recreate those friendships. And that's the foundational theme of the novel.
There's also some important stuff in here about how, as friends, we often fail each other at certain points. Why is that something that's important to write about as well?
We do. You know, it's been saying there's been a lot of love stories written about love, but there haven't been many love stories written about friendship. And for me, yeah, this is not a novel of perfect people. It's not a novel about perfect friends. You know, I think too often in our lives, we all hurt each other in some way, big and small. We can betray one another. We don't be the friend that others deserve sometimes. And that's what this book explores too. But it's also a novel of forgiveness, you know, not only forgiving ourselves, but forgiving others. And that's a big part of, I think, what we learn as we grow older and grow up. And, you know, these four women overcome so much in their lives to, you know, reclaim the friendships that they once had, the dreams they once had, and try to become the people they think they can be.
Right. That's a tall order in the midst of all these other things that we're all doing at the same time.
It's a tall order, but I think, you know, we need one another more than we ever have. And I think we have forgotten what matters most, and that is each other and what being a friend is. You know, my grandmother gave me a plaque that I still have in my cottage in Saugatuck, Michigan, that says, a friend knows we're not perfect, but they treat us as if we are. And I think that sums up what our forever friends are all about.
So this moment in which we need to be there for each other, is there anybody who you're trying to be there for right now?
Yes, there is. You know, my grandparents are all gone, and I lost my mother in 2009 and my father in 2015. And I've experienced a lot of loss in my life. I lost my brother when he was young as well. And I think there is a scar tissue that develops over your soul when you've experienced so much loss in your life. And for me, it has made me reticent at times to step up and be there for people who need me in their lives. You know, and this last year has really taught me that life is so, so, so fragile, and we need each other more than ever. And so I've stepped up for my friends in ways that I've never imagined. You know, they've experienced incredible loss. People have lost family members. They've lost friends. People are still sick. They're, you know, COVID long haulers that I know all over the country, you know, nurses that are still vaccinating people that just need to talk to me every single day. And so I've really carved out a lot of time in a busy schedule to try and be there for all of them more than I ever have before.
You know, it's funny because on the one hand, it's important that we cut ourselves some slack as a lot of people are going through work difficulties or, you know, taking care of family, kids or parents or friends who aren't well right now. And you want to cut yourself some slack, but at the same time, it's so easy to just fall into the overwhelm and, you know, not reach out to somebody who might be in a tough spot. I don't know what the medicine is for that exactly, to remember that we might get something out of it ourselves too if we can't make time for that.
We do. You know, that's a great point. I feel, you know, despite the horrific last 14 months, I've become a different person in many ways. You know, I think that I've found that I can be stronger than I've ever imagined, that I can be there for people who need me. And, you know, these are friends that you talk about friendship. These were people that were there through, you know, loss of my brother, through the loss of my mother, through the loss of my father, have been there for me over and over and over again. And the least that I can do, I think the least that all of us can do, is be there for one another right now, even if it's just to give somebody 10 minutes to talk, or, you know, do more than a text, send a letter, send a longer email. It's vital right now. I don't think we realize how much people need us in their lives right now.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, my guest today is writer Wade Rouse. He's talking to us from his home in Saugatuck. He has a new novel publishing this week called The Clover Girls. We've had conversations with authors and booksellers who encourage us to lean in toward hard things with our reads right now. I mean, there's a lot going on in the country and a lot to think about, but the kind of books that you write have a very different vibe. It's the sort of thing that somebody might pick up when they need a break. I was wondering which kind of book you find yourself reading these days, and maybe also who you do read when you want something that's going to challenge you a bit.
That's a great question. You know, and I agree, and I'm going to say the opposite of that as well. You know, I think sometimes we need to lean in, as you said, into giving ourselves a little bit of slack too. You know, I think we're all trying to be more educated, more informed readers today. And I think what I've seen over the last year has been incredible. You know, there are Black authors and gay authors, Asian American authors who are getting notoriety and attention that they so richly deserve. But there's also a time, I think, in which we need to escape from our own lives and from the hardships that are going on around us. And part of that is by picking up a book that allows us to go on vacation for a little while, that allows us to escape in our own minds, allows us to escape our homes for a bit. And those are the types of books that I write. You know, those are the types of novels I grew up reading with my grandmothers, ones that could be passed along through the generations, no worry about the content, but ones that you know are really going to buoy you and make you laugh and make you think a little bit harder about things that are important in your life. You know, I have a stack of books on my nightstand because publishers send me a lot of books for blurbing, you know, author endorsements that we give one another. And right now I've been fully ensconced in really summer reads, you know, books by Nancy Thayer and Ellen Hildebrand, Mary Kay Andrews, you know, authors that write similarly to me, but, you know, in very different locations, you know, whereas I love to write about, every novel I write is set in a Michigan resort town. They write about Nantucket or the Low Country. And for me, it's important for me to kind of escape my own mind and go on vacation as well. So those are the books that I've been reading, you know, really the last couple of months.
You live in Saugatuck. What exactly happens in a lakeside town during lockdown?
You would think less, but it seems like it never slows down. You know, I grew up in the Missouri Ozarks, and I ended up going on vacation to Saugatuck, and I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the entire state of Michigan. And it's one of those, you know, people used to always say, oh my gosh, I went on vacation, I fell in love with this place. I've got to move there. And I used to think they were, you know, crackpots. But when I went to Saugatuck, I was like, I have to live here. And I ended up buying a place in 2003 and moving full-time in 2006. And, you know, lockdown is, there has been a silver lining to everything, which is the fact that the resort town you think is more slow paced and slower life. You know, it's very Mayberry, but it's, you know, it's actually given people pause. You know, we're staying home more. The town has quieted again, or it has, you know, especially over the winter and last year. You kind of get back to falling in love with what I fell in love with Saugatuck, you know, in the first place. It's the geographical beauty of the area. It's the quietness. It's the river and the lake, you know, the way the aspens sing on the dunes, all of those things that we kind of forget and take for granted, you know, things have quieted again. And that's what I've learned to love again. And I think others have as well, but I see it picking up again. So I think summer's going to be insanely busy.
Right. I have to ask, you're the only person I've met who's from that part of the world, the only person I've met recently. Have you seen the Netflix show Ozark?
Oh, yes. You know, and I love this show. I always think, and pardon many of my Ozarks friends, you know, those folks are actually a little bit classier than where I grew up. That takes place in Lake of the Ozarks. So if you're a true Ozarkian, that really doesn't count as the Ozarks. Lake of the Ozarks is, you know, really where the Kansas City and St. Louis people with money come to summer and buy vacation homes and boat and gamble. I grew up even closer to Branson on the Arkansas border. So, you know, I laugh because I love the show so much, but it really doesn't parallel where I grew up. It was, if you can believe it, it was even rougher for a kid like me in the 1970s, you know, to grow up. You know, I even sang, I remember a middle school talent contest at my rural Ozarks grade school. I sang Delta Dawn, if you remember that song.
Oh, yeah.
While holding a faded rose, and I got heckled off stage. So, you know, that kind of sums up my Ozarks experience.
They weren't feeling Tanya Tucker?
And you've named my favorite version. Yeah, Tanya Tucker is the best version of all of them.
Of
and no, they weren't
it
feeling
is.
It. And I nailed it. It was a great performance.
For those, just as a point of reference, for those who haven't seen the Netflix show Ozark, it is a dark thriller, very dark thriller, about a family from New York that has to go on the lam because the father's involved in shady business dealings, and everything just goes sideways for them. It's sort of like an upside down Schitt's Creek, and with lots of murder and lots of physical violence. The thing that got to me about it was that it kind of peels back the idea of a place that we go for paradise, and how sometimes even those places can have a piece of hellscape to them.
Exactly right. And you know, it's very interesting, as bucolic as where I grew up, it was not easy. And you know, the one thing the show gets right that I experienced is that, you know, people have hard lives. They don't have the opportunities that so many of us do and that we take for granted, you know, and they get by just by you know, kind of working the system as best they can day by day. That's the only way they know to make it. That's the beauty of the show. And I think one of the things they do exceedingly well.
Wade Rouse's new novel is called The Clover Girls, writing as he does as Viola Shipman. And it's available for your summer reads and is considerably more uplifting and less destructive to the soul than the show Ozark. Wade, thank you so much for talking with us. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Next up, how to interpret the CDC's guidance on masks and COVID. It's a huge issue for Michigan's businesses.
I, along with many other retailers throughout the state, throughout the country, were shocked, I think, at just the sudden announcement by the CDC. I think it caught a lot of the states off guard as well. I feel that there's nothing wrong with just a wait and see period.
One shopkeeper in Detroit talks to us about a weekend of new decisions after the break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. When the CDC announced last week that masks were no longer necessary for vaccinated individuals, we saw images and stories of people taking their masks off, from the highest levels of government in the halls of the Capitol and White House to communities all over Michigan. It felt like a moment. Like, is the pandemic over? However, many epidemiologists are reminding us we are still in a pandemic, and masks indoors and with groups of people will be important to curbing the spread of COVID-19. It's confusing. And the line between what's enforceable, what is advisable, and what just comes down to individual decision-making is coming into stark view. With a view from the ground now, we'd like to welcome Rachel Lutz to the show. She's the owner of the Peacock Room, a women's clothing store with two locations in Detroit. Rachel, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us briefly what you've been doing to keep your business alive during the various stages of lockdown?
That's a great question. First and foremost, we've been doing our best to keep our staff safe, our customers safe. And we've been continuing to, follow the formula of retail, you know, great environment, service, great product. And it's been challenging here. So we've actually been taking some of our sales online. We've been doing Facebook Live shows, but our brick and mortar traffic does remain strong.
Yeah. And how have you made your decisions about what's safe for customers and employees? I mean, what guidance have you been relying on?
I've been relying on the guidance of science. I'm the daughter of a nurse, the goddaughter of a pediatrician. I grew up in a household that really respected science. So I've been following the CDC guidelines. I've been following the state guidelines as best I can. And honestly, I've been erring on the side of safer. I think that there's a spectrum of safe, and I'd rather kind of err on the side of, keeping people safer.
So when the CDC made this announcement last week saying that it would be okay for vaccinated people indoors and outdoors to go maskless, did it make you want to change anything that you're doing in the stores?
No, nothing. I, along with many other retailers throughout the state, throughout the country, were shocked, I think, at just the sudden announcement by the CDC. I think it caught a lot of the states off guard as well. I feel that there's nothing wrong with just a wait and see period. So again, erring on the side of safer, most businesses that I've talked to, most retailers made the immediate decision of, well, we're still going to require masks, which is our right as private businesses. We are allowed to still keep that as a store policy. So we are still requiring masks to shop in our store, and we're still happy to accommodate people virtually or other ways if they don't want to wear a mask in our store. But if you are going to be in-store shopping, we did not change our rules at all. We are still distancing, we are still cleaning, and we are still requiring masks.
How does Detroit's public health situation play into your daily decisions about how you're going to run things?
We have a mix of both Detroit residents as customers and also folks from outside the city as well. But our local vaccine rates are hovering, I think, somewhere in the 30%.
33.7%, according to the city's COVID information page.
Thank you. So that definitely does play a role. If we had a higher vaccination rate, I'm willing to obviously go back and review that. And we will not wear masks forever. That's definitely not the end game. I mean, as more information becomes available, we shift strategy. That's what the CDC also is doing. They're not reversing what they've been saying. They're not taking, they're not doing an about face. The more we learn, the more we reflect, and the more we strategize going forward. But again, the CDC decision was so sudden that a lot of retailers didn't know what to do and didn't know what we were allowed to do.
Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about how you and your staff are approaching these conversations? What do you do if someone enters one of the storefronts and maybe isn't respecting the posted rules?
So we've occasionally had a person, forget that their mask wasn't on, although we are inside buildings that require masks. So by the time you make it to our door, chances are you've already passed a sign that reminds you. We had a woman come in the other day without a mask who quickly said that she had just dropped hers outside and it was dirty and she was asking for a disposable, which we happily gave her. But we are lucky to have amazing customers who have been really compliant. I've heard from other retailers, though, that they are not so lucky. And unfortunately, when there are unclear guidelines or a sudden policy shift that hasn't been communicated to the states, with enough time to adjust, every time that happens, you're exposing retail, restaurant, service workers to verbal and potentially physical abuse. And we've heard of many incidents like this happening throughout the state. And there was a spike in these incidents right after the CDC announcement.
Can I just ask, Rachel? I mean, you got into your business because you cared about fashion, and you had a real passion for helping people with their clothes. But here you are in a situation where you're picking up pieces of public health knowledge that I don't know if that was ever really part of your business plan. What's it been like to keep track of the public health metrics in addition to running the business?
I mean, obviously, no one signed up for, I keep hearing that expression, no one signed up for this as retailers. Retail workers, restaurant workers, service workers, we are in this industry because we are passionate about people. And of course, we want people to feel safe. So I would say that we're doing the best we can under the circumstances. And if this is what we have to do to keep serving the people that we love serving, we'll do it. But we are just here to, give you what you need, whether it's a meal that you don't have to clean up after, whether it's, a great new outfit, whether it's a new sofa for your house. We want to be there to serve you. We are not interested in having political discussions. We just want to be there to make sure that we get you what you need. So just a reminder to please be kind to retail workers as you navigate this. And as a default, just keep wearing a mask until someone says it's okay to take it off in their space.
Rachel, one last question. Have you and your staff been able to keep healthy during all this?
Thanks for asking. We did have a COVID scare with a staff member early on. Thankfully, it did turn out okay. But I want to make clear, there's the CDC guidelines, and then there's just how we treat each other. When you walk into a store without a mask, the worker that you're walking past may still be dealing with the trauma of losing a coworker or a loved one. And I think that wearing a mask is, at this point, it's a gesture of respect and compassion, not just health.
Rachel Lutz of the Peacock Room, with two locations providing women's clothing in Detroit. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here to help us make sense of the latest in pandemic policy is Peter Jacobson. He's professor emeritus of health management and policy at the University of Michigan, and also co-director of the Mid-States region of the Network for Public Health Law. Peter, welcome to Stateside. Peter Jacobson, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, it's nice to be with you, April.
To what extent are decisions like the one that we got from the CDC last week, to what extent are these theoretical versus binding?
It's an interesting question. Your opening statement of making sense of the CDC recommendations is very optimistic. So as far as I can tell, most people are just confused about them. On one level, it's clearly theoretical in the sense that There's no opportunity for business owners, for individuals to distinguish between those who are vaccinated and those who aren't. And so that creates the problem on the practical level. There's just no way to enforce this guidance. So it becomes a symbolic statement. There's nothing wrong with symbolic statements on some issues, but on this one, I think it tends to confuse more than help.
Well, if you were in a position to run a business or, I don't know, maybe a school right now, how would you approach decision-making about masks and physical distancing, given the guidance that we just got?
For me, I would think of this as, what's the least restrictive alternative, since we don't know who's vaccinated and who isn't? And I would still rely on mask wearing. So if I'm operating a business, I don't want to expose my employees, certainly, but nor do I want the public to be concerned about being exposed to COVID-19 when they enter my business or school. So I would opt for mask wearing in my business, and for schools, mask wearing as much as is feasible. It's easier in a typical retail business to have everyone wear masks and some social distancing. Within schools, it's harder. It's always been harder that the kids want to socialize and want to be together. But as much as possible, let's have them wear masks and social distance.
I've seen anecdotal stories about folks who maybe work in service industry jobs in places where public concern about COVID is considerably less, where there's resistance to mask wearing, where people have been asked by their employers not to wear masks so that they don't make customers uncomfortable. What's a responsible way to look at this? I mean, should this be about county case positivity rates?
Yes and no. The yes part of it is, let's not look to people's attitudes, but let's look at the data. If the data show in your area low case positivity rates, by definition, you're going to have less exposure to COVID-19. In areas with higher case positivity rates, that's not the case. That said, I think everyone should focus on what their responsibility is to other people and to the community at large. And the resistors have made the case that this is all about self-reliance, personal responsibility. That's fine. I applaud that, but it ignores the reality that if you're not wearing a mask, if you're not cognizant of your potential exposure to someone else, you're being irresponsible. We have an obligation to be concerned about how our behavior affects others.
If we do bounce the ball back into the court of individual decision-making, what has to happen? What has to be in place in order for that to be a successful strategy?
Well, I think people need to recognize that these vaccines are spectacular in protecting individuals and protecting against exposure to others. Those who are fully vaccinated can largely return to normal pre-COVID-19 lives. Those who aren't are still at risk. So it seems to me that what we want to focus on is appealing to those vaccine hesitants, not the vaccine, the so-called anti-vaxxers, those who under no circumstances will get vaccinated. We really can't reach them. We have no mechanism to get them to change their minds. But people who are hesitant should look at how well the vaccines have performed. The actually very low levels of reinfection, and the reality that once you're fully vaccinated, the level of exposing others is remarkably low. So let's try to reach the vaccine hesitants with what we know, why it's in their best interests, and why it's in the best interest of protecting their loved ones and those around them.
There's an awful lot of decision-making to be done right now. We all have our own personal choice about whether or not to get vaccinated. But we also have to decide how safe we feel around coworkers, fellow shoppers, and if a person owns or manages a business, there's this assessment of relative risk for your employees and your customers. As I mentioned, you know, your work has really centered around helping guide people through questions that pertain to public health for people who are administrators, either in private sector or any number of other kinds of settings. We're hearing that it is exhausting keeping an eye on the ball of public health while maintaining a business. Do you have any advice for business owners?
My advice is to keep your employees safe, have them, encourage them to be vaccinated, provide incentives, mandate it if you need to. And the same goes for protecting your customers. We know that wearing a mask helps prevent the spread of disease. Why not just say, our goal is to protect our customers. We ask that you wear a mask. We require that you wear a mask when you enter our business.
We're talking about a problem that spreads across multiple jurisdictions with multiple different COVID infection rates and hospitalization rates. It's got to be confusing from the standpoint of just the average person moving in and out of businesses and in and out of our lives.
Absolutely.
As well. Do you think there's a solve for this, or are we just in for a period of confusion and some disorder going into the next stage of the pandemic?
Yes, I think we're not going to solve this problem anytime soon. I've been surprised at the level of resistance to what I think has been a series of reasonable restrictions to protect the public's health. That's been a deeper, more entrenched, embedded resistance than I'd expected. But it turns out that there was similar reluctance to wear masks in the 1918 to 1920 flu epidemic that killed millions. So it's nothing new. We are a society that really focuses on, revolves around individual responsibility, protecting individual rights. A pandemic presents a problem of protecting the collective. And we don't do that well in this society. And so I think that sort of helps capture why there's so much confusion, why there's so much resistance. I don't have a solution. It seems obvious that CDC doesn't have a solution. I think the public health officials in Michigan and other states have done what they can to inform the public of how the pandemic can be defeated, and that's through vaccination, through wearing masks, but they can't enforce it. It's your earlier question about symbolic laws goes to enforcement. It's very hard to enforce when the public doesn't either trust the science, trust the government, or trust one another. And until we deal with that trust problem, we're not going to resolve these kinds of collective public health issues.
Peter Jacobson is Professor Emeritus of Health Management and Policy at the University of Michigan. Peter, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, April.
And that's our show for today. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, by Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. See you Tuesday.